Hi. It's great that you could all make it today. So I just wanted to, before getting started, just briefly reiterate what Jim said about the importance of interaction between artists and scientists. That's really the point of this workshop, so that all of you can hopefully collaborate, perhaps, or just, you know, get inspired by or inspire us in turn. And I was recently in a panel discussion about creativity in art and science. And during that discussion, the question was asked, you know, what is the importance of collaboration? So I was sort of on the spot, and I had to come up with something good. But thinking it over, it seems to me that there's sort of it's a two-way thing. So on the one hand, as I understand it, art is really about, you know, confronting ideas at the forefront of culture and trying to figure out our place in the universe. And these days, it's very hard to do that without some of the leading ideas in science. So I think there's a natural vector from science to art. But also in science, we have a bit of a challenge ourselves, because to get anywhere these days, you have to become very specialized. And often what happens is people become very focused and they lose the big picture. And an interaction with artists can often make you step back and look at the big picture and think more broadly about your research. And secondly, there's also an incentive to present your research in a very cold, objective, factual way. You know, you don't want to hype it, you just want to say it as it is. And sometimes in that process, you know, you lose the inspiration, the kind of wonder that's there. And so I think, you know, artists can really help perhaps bring back that sense of wonder that's there in science. Anyhow, that's my spiel. I'm just going to get started now. So as Jim said, I'm one of the researchers here, and my field of research is the foundations of quantum mechanics. I've also worked on quantum information theory. And I'm not going to talk about those topics much today, though there will be a bit about information theory at the end. But I was recently asked to give a talk at a philosophy conference about the role of information theory in physics. And as I was thinking about that talk, I realized that there is a sort of a revolution happening, I think, these days, wherein we are rethinking all of physics from an information theoretic perspective. And it's very exciting, but it's important to realize what kind of a revolution it is. So we're used to thinking about revolutions as things that, you know, once they happen, they show that the best theory that came before is wrong, and it replaces it with a new theory. You know, that's one kind of revolution. But there's another kind of revolution which happens more slowly, and it's more conceptual, I would say. And what it does is it changes the perspective. So the theory might not change, it might not replace the theory, but the perspective on the theory changes. So one example is action principles in the 17th and 18th centuries. So people started thinking about Newton's theory in terms of trajectories rather than impulses. And that had a huge impact. It didn't change Newton's theory, but it changed the perspective, and it led to a lot of innovation. And I think another great example of that is the use of symmetries in physics. That was something that really changed the face of physics, but didn't actually overthrow anything that came before. It just became a critical part of all of our best physical theories. So I got to thinking about the role of symmetry in my own research and more broadly. And this talk is sort of a very broad, basic overview of where concepts of symmetry show up in physics. So I'm not by any means an expert on most of these topics, but I thought it'd be fun to just go over these sorts of things. So let me start by talking about symmetries of spatial configurations. I'll get my pointer. And please do interrupt me at any point with questions. So the idea here is that if I have some figure, some geometrical figure, for example, then a particular transformation of that figure will be said to be a symmetry of it if it leaves the figure invariant. So if it takes the figure to itself, then that's a symmetry of the figure. So what kinds of transformations am I talking about? Well, there's translations in space, rotations, reflections about an axis or a plane, scalings, wherein everything is expanded or contracted. And then relative to these sorts of transformations, you can identify the symmetries of an object. So here's a particularly interesting case, the Nautilus. So the symmetry here is an interesting one, where if you start at the origin and you translate radially, and rotate and scale in certain relations, then you'll find that this thing is similar to itself, right? So if I take a given bit and I rotate it and I move it out and I scale it up, it maps onto itself. So that's the symmetry of this object. If we go to more simple, starting in more simple cases, if I just look at rotations in a plane, okay? So if I ask, well, what are all the possible symmetries an object can have relative to just rotations in the plane? Well, it's the types of symmetries are called the cyclic groups. So this is basically no symmetry at all. This is symmetric under a rotation by 180 degrees. This is symmetric under rotations by multiples of 120 degrees, and so on. So they're all symmetries under rotations by the full circle, 360 degrees, over some integer n, 3, 4, 5, etc. Another kind of symmetry would be if you have this rotational symmetry, but you also have symmetry with respect to reflections. So here, no rotational symmetry, but symmetry relative to a reflection on this plane. Here, I've got symmetry relative to reflection on this plane and rotation by 180 degrees, which means I also have a symmetry of reflection about this plane. And I can have this threefold symmetry with reflectional symmetry, fourfold, fivefold, sixfold. And these guys here are very familiar symmetries because this one is the symmetry group of the triangle. These are the rotations by 120 degrees and these reflections about these planes here are all the symmetries of the triangle. And these are the symmetries of the square and the pentagon and the hexagon and so forth. If you go to rotations in three-dimensional space and you consider reflections as well, things become a lot more complicated. I just enumerated for you all the symmetries with respect to rotations and reflections in a plane. And I'm not going to do that for the three-dimensional case, but you can list them all. There's an infinite number of them. But they include all the ones I just described as special cases where you're just rotating in 2D. But they also include the symmetries of the Platonic solids, which you may be familiar with. So, if you ask what are all the rotations and reflections you can do to the tetrahedron that takes it to itself, you find the symmetry group, the tetrahedral symmetry group. And there's a cubic symmetry, and so on. Okay, so that should all be sort of familiar. Now let's say we are interested in including translations as well. So take as a simple example a two-dimensional surface, and imagine that the pattern repeats itself in one direction. Okay, so there's a one-dimensional repetition pattern. And then you can ask, what are all the possible symmetries such an object can have? So the idea is that these objects are going to be symmetric under translations by some constant amount and all multiples of that translation. But they're going to have some further symmetries as well. So for example, this one here will be symmetric about a reflection in along the axis of translation. This one is going to be symmetric about reflections in these axes. And so you can figure out what all of the possible symmetries are, and these are them. And these are called the Fries groups. And what you find is that these symmetries are very common in various border mosaic patterns. And underneath each of them, you can see the mapping to these ones here. So these sorts of symmetries appear in art. If you go even more complicated and you say, what are the symmetries of patterns on two-dimensional surfaces which are repetitive in two directions? So you have sort of a two-dimensional unit cell which repeats itself in two directions now. You find that there are 17. And I won't go through all of them, but this is a sort of a schematic of the different wallpaper patterns that have each of these 17 different symmetries. And there are significant constraints on what kinds of symmetries these things can have because they need to repeat across space. So they're able to have twofold, threefold, fourfold, or sixfold symmetry, but not fivefold. So you will never see a pattern that repeats in two dimensions that has pentagonal symmetry. And you can't have sevenfold symmetry or octagonal symmetry either. It's mathematically not possible because of the constraint of having to repeat. So you start to see the idea that you can start to classify symmetries. And then you can start looking for where these sorts of things might appear in nature. And so A nice example is the honeycomb lattice of bees. So this is a hexagonal symmetry. That's one of those 17 possibilities. And if you ask, well, why this symmetry as opposed to another? Well, the plausible explanation is that this is actually the best way of packing the cylinders together such that the space between them is minimized. A lot of what I'm telling you right now is you can find in this wonderful book by Hermann Weyl. So he was a mathematician, a theoretical physicist from the early 20th century. This is just a fabulous book that talks about the interplay of symmetries and art and science and biology. And so a lot of my narrative for the first bit of this talk is sort of stolen straight out of Weyl. But I want to mention a couple of things that Weyl says. So Weyl points out that if you go and look at the patterns that were present in antiquity, in particular in the Arab world, you'll find all these 17 groups of symmetries for these two-dimensional patterns. They were all known. And so he says that in a sense, the art of ornament contains in implicit form the oldest piece of mathematics known to us. Now, the amazing thing is that the proof that there are only these 17 symmetries only came out in the 20th century. But back in the 13th century, this was already known to the artists. So here's a nice example where the artists were ahead of the mathematicians in this game. And now there's an interesting second bit to this story. So Weyl goes on to mention that, as I told you, there's no five-fold symmetry pattern that you can have in two dimensions. And so he mentions that the Arabs fumbled around much with the number five, but they were, of course, never able to honestly insert a central symmetry of five in their ornamental designs of double infinite rapport, which means repeating along two axes. He points out that they did have nice attempts at generating this sort of symmetry, but of course we know that it's not possible. Now, Weyl wrote this before some interesting discoveries were made in the 60s. People started thinking about tilings of the plane, and they asked whether it was possible to have an aperiodic tiling, so a finite number of tiles, which you could set together to cover the plane, the whole two-dimensional plane, with no gaps. And it turns out there are sets of tiles like this. And you can have five-fold symmetry in one of these aperiodic tilings. And in the 60s, these things were discovered in nature. And the crystals that have this kind of symmetry are called quasicrystals. And in fact, the Nobel Prize this year in chemistry was won by the discoverer of quasicrystals. That's another way in which the artists were ahead of the mathematicians, because these fumblings with the number five were actually versions of these quasicrystals. Perhaps not understood mathematically to be possible to span the plane, but in an experimental sense, they were able to generate what today we would recognize to be fragments of quasicrystals. Okay. If you go further and you say, what about the designs in three-dimensional spaces, which are repetitive in three directions, you get, again, a finite set of possibilities. There are now 230 unique ways that an object can have symmetry of this sort. And this is the basis of crystallography. Okay, so crystallographers know very well what these 230 different types are. I don't. But they're well categorized, and they're used to describe the structure of matter. Weyl makes an interesting comment about this 230 unique patterns. He basically says, well, the 17 patterns in 2D are, have all been discovered, but artists don't really go in for three-dimensional ornaments. And I thought, well, they do in a sense. I mean, sculpture is a three-dimensional ornament, but it doesn't repeat. So then I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to, have a three-dimensional repeating ornament? How could you do that? And I realized that maybe with 3D printers, we could print out a unit cell with a particular symmetry, build it up, block them together, and have experiment with all 230 symmetries of a three-dimensional system. So that's just a crazy idea that I throw out there in case any of you have 3D printers and are willing to try it out. But the idea here is that the power of symmetries is that we can categorize what the possibilities are. We can classify them. And we can look for new possibilities that we haven't seen before. And you know, wouldn't it be great if we could learn crystallography through sculpture? You know, that would maybe make crystallography a lot more fun. So here's an example of a crystal. Does anyone recognize it? I know you recognize it. Does anybody else recognize it? Jim? Is it what? Nope, not carbon. Ice, yes, it's ice. So each of the blue balls is oxygen with two hydrogens, and you've got six water molecules. So each one of these is a water molecule. Six water molecules combine in this hexagonal pattern. That's how they minimize their energy. And then they make a whole sheet in this hexagonal pattern, and the sheets are stacked up one on top of each other. And you know, as I said, this is one of those patterns that you're allowed in crystallography. It has a six-fold symmetry. And now, interesting fact, you know, when you look at the patterns that ice makes in snowflakes, of course, there's the six-fold symmetry. It's inherited from the underlying microscopic structure. And of course, you can do the same thing for crystals of different substances. You can see the symmetry of the crystal as a result of the underlying microscopic structure. Yes? It was Kepler who came up with that? Interesting. I didn't know that. You'll explain that this afternoon. Excellent. So now I want to change tack a little bit and tell you about something called Curie's principle. So this is Pierre Curie. Perhaps you know him as one of the discoverers of radioactivity. So Curie was looking at crystals, and he was studying the electrical and magnetic effects induced by crystals. And he was noticing that the symmetries of the electric and magnetic effects that he was seeing were tightly correlated with those of the underlying crystal. And he eventually developed the following principle. So let me read it out to you. The symmetry elements, or the symmetries, of the causes must be found in their effects. But the converse is not true. That is, the effects can be more symmetric than the causes. So maybe a slightly clearer version of that would be any asymmetry in an effect must be found in its causes. So what he's saying is that, look, if you see your electric or magnetic phenomena with a particular asymmetry, it fails to have a certain rotational symmetry, for example, then when you find the causes of that phenomena, you'll see the asymmetry there as well. There's no way that the causes of the phenomena could have that symmetry but the effects lack it. So another way of putting that would be that only asymmetry can beget asymmetry. And that's very natural, because the dynamics of these systems basically preserve symmetries. So you can't just generate asymmetry from nothing. It's a kind of conservation law, if you will. And this is sort of, very few people know that this is called Curie's principle. I only discovered recently that there was anything called Curie's principle, because all physicists just know this intuitively. And if you're in a talk and somebody says, okay, here's the result, here's what we observed, and there's some asymmetry, they'll say, excuse me, but can you explain, where does that asymmetry come from? Do you have an explanation? Because it can't just arise out of nowhere. So everybody sort of knows this intuitively, but it's nice that it has a name. Here's a simple example of it. If you see an asymmetry, then there's probably a cause, and indeed, in this case, there's some difference in the softness of the soil under the tower. But that's not so interesting. So I want to go to a more interesting set of examples that are, not electric and magnetic phenomena, but maybe just a little bit more fun. So bilateral symmetry. So this is just symmetry of reflection about a plane. So if you look around the natural world, you'll see that a lot of organisms seem to have this bilateral symmetry. And so you might say, why is that? Why are there so many organisms out there that have this bilateral symmetry? An interesting question. But maybe it's the wrong question. Maybe the right question is not, why do we find this symmetry, but rather, why do we find this asymmetry? Why aren't there more symmetries in the organisms we see? Why aren't they symmetric about rotations, why aren't they completely symmetric? Maybe that's the more interesting question. And indeed, this is Weil's argument I'm repeating here. He says, let's say you go into the ocean and you take a very microscopic organism. That microscopic organism is being pushed around by forces. It basically doesn't see gravity at all. So it doesn't know up from down. And all directions are the same for it. So its environment is completely rotationally symmetric. And many such organisms will take on a spherical symmetry because their environment has that symmetry. If, on the other hand, you take a larger organism where gravity is important and perhaps the ocean floor is important to it, then all of a sudden the symmetry is broken. Not every direction is the same. Down is a very special direction. You still can't tell the difference between any other direction, and so you still have a rotational symmetry about this axis, but you've broken the symmetry of top versus bottom because that symmetry has been broken by the environment. Now let's take another example. Suppose you have an organism that actually propels itself forward. It has locomotion. Many such organisms break another symmetry. The front and the back are not the same. So unlike the jellyfish, which sort of doesn't have a front side and a back side, organisms that have a certain kind of locomotion do. And perhaps you can explain this by the fact that most ways of generating locomotion will have to break that sort of symmetry. If I'm going to build a rocket, for example, then I've got to eject rocket propellant out the back to move this way, and that's going to break the symmetry of the rocket. Okay, so if you have an explanation in terms of an adaptive need, to break that symmetry, that maybe achieving locomotion is easiest if you break that symmetry, then you're down to you've still broken the top-down symmetry because of gravity, you've broken the front-back symmetry. What's left? There's only the bilateral symmetry left. And Weyl suggests that that is an explanation of why we see bilateral symmetry so much, is that that's the only symmetry that basically, the environment doesn't break, and so the organism doesn't really see a need to break it. Of course, organisms do break bilateral symmetry in more subtle ways often. So, our internal organs break bilateral symmetry, and there are good reasons for that. So, for example, if you want to have a really long intestinal tract, it's very hard to do that while maintaining bilateral symmetry. So, there are adaptive good reasons why we break those kinds of symmetries. So this was all to sort of give you a kind of a loose version of Curie's principle about how the asymmetries that you observe in a phenomena means that there must be some asymmetries in the cause of that phenomena. Okay, how am I doing on time? Jenny, are you keeping track? 20 past now. Oh. Sorry, 20 past 10, yes. Very good. And I started right at 10, yeah? Okay. So I'm running behind. I have two more topics. So I've told you about symmetries of spatial configurations. Now I want to talk about symmetries of laws. So a law of nature has a particular transformation as a symmetry if it's invariant under that transformation. What does that mean? Let me give you an example. So this is the example of the principle of relativity due to Galileo. This is a very long quote. I won't read it to you, but let me read bits of it. Galileo says, imagine that you're in the hull of a ship. And you've brought along with you all kinds of stuff, like some flies, some butterflies, other small flying animals, a bowl of water with some fish in it, a bottle that drops water into a vessel beneath, and so on. And now you do some experiments in two different scenarios, one where the ship is at rest, and the other where the ship is moving uniformly at a constant velocity, with no turbulence, just moving straight. And what you find is that you see exactly the same thing in both cases. You find that the butterflies, which fly in with equal ease in all directions when the ship is at rest, also fly with equal ease in all directions when the ship is moving. They don't have to work hard to keep up with the ship. And you find that nothing in any of the phenomena you observe can tell the difference between the ship being at rest and the ship being in uniform motion, as long as there's no turbulence. This is perhaps familiar. The place where this always strikes me in my life is when I'm sitting on the train, and there's a train right beside me, and I see it start moving relative to my train, and you can't see the sky or the ground. And you never know, is it that we've left, or is it just that this train is moving? Because it feels exactly the same if you're in uniform motion. You can't tell. So that's the Galilean principle of relativity. Now, I want to show how Huygens, he'll be on the next slide, used that to solve an outstanding problem in physics in an extremely clever way. So René Descartes was thinking about collisions. And he had a whole theory of collisions which was almost entirely wrong. He had one case that was right. The case that he got right was the case that was very symmetric. He said if you have two equal masses moving towards one another with equal velocity, then what happens is that they're going to bounce back and they're going to move off with equal, the same and equal and opposite velocities, the entirely symmetric scenario. Okay, but you know there are more interesting cases. Like suppose you have the one on the right at rest and the one on the left coming in at twice the velocity, what happens then? So it turns out Descartes got that one wrong. He made a prediction about what would happen, which we know is not right. But at the time, it was very difficult to deduce what the answer to this problem was. But Huygens, a Dutch physicist, made an appeal to symmetry that solved this problem in a very beautiful way. So he used Galileo's principle of relativity. So he said, imagine you've got a guy on a boat, and the boat is moving uniformly relative to the shore. And this guy in the boat is going to do the experiment where he brings the two balls together, coming in at equal velocities. The balls are equal mass, and they're going to bounce back. And then the guy on the shore is going to watch that. And now imagine that the boat is moving at exactly the velocity v in this direction here, moving to the right. So this ball here is moving this way with velocity v relative to the bank. Relative to the boat. The boat is moving this way with velocity v relative to the bank, so this ball, relative to the guy in the bank, is at rest. The other ball is moving this way at velocity v with respect to the boat, and the boat is moving this way at velocity v with respect to the bank, so it's moving at velocity 2v with respect to the bank. So the guy in the bank says, ah, that's the scenario I'm interested in, 2v this way and at rest. But he knows now that, you know, if the balls inside the boat behave in that way that Descartes thought they should, just by bouncing back and taking on equal and opposite velocities, then after the collision's over, the guy in the bank sees the one on the right, which is now moving with velocity v this way with respect to the boat, and the boat's moving with velocity v with respect to the bank, it's going with velocity 2v this way, and the other one, which is moving with velocity v with respect to the boat that way, and the whole boat's moving with velocity v with respect to the bank, is at rest. So 2v goes to zero, and then the first guy stops, and the second guy moves off with velocity 2v. So if it had been the case that this collision on the boat didn't act the same way as it would on the shore, right? If Descartes' first law, the right one, only held true on the shore and did something different in the boat, then you couldn't make that inference. But because you have this symmetry, because the laws of physics are the same on the shore and in the boat moving at uniform velocity, you can immediately infer what's going to happen in the case where one's moving at 2v and the other's moving at velocity 0. So you can actually go from this one case where you know what has to happen by virtue of symmetry to the solution to all the collision problems where the masses are of equal size. And that, to my mind, is an extremely elegant idea. And it's been an idea that's been used over and over again in physics ever since. So Einstein used it in the special theory of relativity. He basically used the relativity principle of Galileo together with the constancy of the speed of light. In the general theory of relativity, he used a similar kind of symmetry principle called the equivalence principle, where he noted, much like Galileo did about the ship, that if you're in an elevator that's accelerating uniformly through free space at 10 meters per second squared, or you're sitting on the surface of the Earth where the gravitational field is 10 meters per second squared, say in an elevator, so you can't tell which it is, you'll observe all the same phenomena. Everything will be exactly the same. And it's rather intuitive because if you think about dropping a ball in the rocket, the rocket is accelerating upwards. So the ball is just here, but the rocket is gaining on it. And because the rocket's accelerating, the rate at which it's gaining on it, the distance to the floor, keeps getting smaller faster. And so what it looks like inside the elevator is that the ball is getting closer to the floor, and the distance between it and the floor is getting smaller faster. It's accelerating towards the floor, exactly as you would have it in the case of gravity. So Einstein used this principle while he was building general theory of relativity. And this is just a quote from Wigner pointing out that from that point on, essentially, Einstein had basically reversed a trend. Rather than deriving the symmetries from the laws of motion, people went the other way. People start with the symmetries, and then they derive the laws of motions from them. So they say, well, we know that the nature must have certain kinds of symmetries. What sorts of laws of physics obey those symmetries? That's how theories are built today. So symmetries, as I say, are deeply embedded in the way we do things. So here's my final topic, and then I'll conclude. And this is the connection with my own research. So I've talked about symmetries of spatial configurations, symmetries of laws. This is symmetries of information. As I said, information, the informational perspective on physics is gaining ground. And so this is a marriage between the symmetric perspective and the informational perspective. So I'm going to talk about states of knowledge now, not states of reality. And a state of knowledge is going to have a particular transformation as a symmetry if it's invariant under that transformation. So let me give you a bit of background to make sense of that. Here's the kind of scenario we think about in communication protocols, in information theory. Alice wants to send a message to Bob. So she encodes that message in zeros and ones. Maybe she uses the ASCII code or something, sends it over to Bob. Bob decodes it, gets the message. But here's another kind of information communication protocol, which is quite different. Suppose Alice and Bob are in their spaceships, and they don't know how they're aligned relative to one another. So if they had access to the fixed stars, then Alice might say, well, my z-axis is pointing at Polaris, and then Bob would know. But if they don't have access to the fixed stars, if they have no way of describing a direction in space, then the only way that they could possibly agree on a direction is if Alice actually sends something like an arrow to Bob and says, this is what I mean by my z-axis. And then Bob could say, now I see how our two z-axes are aligned. So the kind of information Alice has to send to Bob is very different in this case. We call it unspeakable information. It can't be described with zeros and ones. It has to transform non-trivially under rotations. So the reason we were interested in these sorts of problems is because they come up in applications. If you want to build a ship and you want to know where you are, then you want to have some very good gyroscopes and you want to have protocols for aligning your gyroscopes. You want to have protocols for synchronizing distant clocks and keeping clocks that keep good time. You also want a good global positioning system, which is about locating objects in space. And all these things require transmission of information that can't be just described in terms of zeros and ones, that have to have that have to transform in a particular way under symmetry groups. And of course, the reason we look at these things is because typically quantum theory can give you an advantage for these sorts of tasks. But I'm not going to say much about quantum theory. All right, so I have to tell you what a state of knowledge is. I've left that undefined so far. The point is that when you do communication, you often have to contend with noise. So Alice sends to Bob a zero, but Bob only receives a zero with 80% probability, and he receives a one with 20% probability. So sometimes he's mistaken. So he only gets so much information from Alice. We can quantify how much information he gets. If Alice wants to reduce the probability of error, she might send her zero three times over. And then Bob could measure all three of them. And if the majority of them are zero and the minority are one, he says, well, it's probably zero. And so Bob can make his probability of error lower and lower by doing something called error correction. So you can take this probability distribution, which characterizes Bob's knowledge of what the bit Alice encoded really was, and you can quantify how much information Bob has about Alice's bit in terms of that probability distribution. And so you can do the same thing with unspeakable information. So if you have an arrow that points in some direction, this sphere corresponds to all the possible directions it might point in. And so if Alice sends, say, her z-axis, an arrow pointing along Alice's z-axis, over to Bob, well, noise could make it such that Bob doesn't always receive something pointing along z. He could receive something pointing along other directions, and the probability of receiving something along another direction falls off like, say, this kind of curve here. So it's a very similar situation to what you have here. So now Bob's knowledge of what direction Alice is trying to encode is characterized by this probability distribution, and we can come up with measures of how much information Bob has about Alice's direction in terms of that thing. And then a sort of a brief footnote here. According to me, quantum states are states of knowledge. I could talk for hours about this. That's what I talk about most of the time. So if you want to get me going later, ask me why quantum states are not states of reality and why they're states of knowledge. But this is why we got interested. And I'm just giving you the story, the classical story. But a very similar story can be told in the case of quantum states. OK, so now you know, what does it mean for a state of knowledge to have symmetry? Well, it's just the standard thing. I think of this now as a geometric object. If I have a uniform distribution over the whole sphere, that has all possible symmetries. You know, it's symmetric under all rotations. If I, say, make it an ellipsoid, which is wider over here and narrower at the poles, then it only has rotational symmetry about the z-axis. Or I could, it has rotational symmetry and reflection symmetry about the equatorial plane. This guy here only has rotational symmetry about the z-axis. This guy here has additional symmetries, like if I rotate by 90 degrees about an axis coming out of the plane. So all these different probability distributions can now also be described as having various symmetries. And now you can define a measure of asymmetry. A measure of asymmetry of a state of knowledge is defined by a measure of the information that can be extracted from it. So as I said, every one of these things allows Bob to extract a certain amount of information about the direction Alice is really trying to send. And for different distributions, there's different amounts of information. So the uniform distribution, Bob gets no information. Alice is equally likely, if Alice encodes Z, but it comes to Bob as equally likely any direction, he gets no information at all about where Z is. If it's this distribution, he gets a lot more information. If it's this distribution, he gets even more information because his error is a lot smaller. So you can now not only talk about the symmetries and the asymmetries, you can talk about how much asymmetry there is. Okay, so this is my last slide. There's a principle in information theory, which is roughly speaking about conservation of information. Technically, it's called the data processing inequality. But it basically says that the amount of information in a set of signals cannot be increased by processing. Alice sends something to Bob. It's experienced some noise. Bob doesn't have access to the systems that cause the noise. They're part of the environment. They're long gone. He can't undo that noise. He just has what he's got. That's all he has to tell him about what Alice actually encoded. That's clear. It turns out that that statement, given the mapping I've just talked about, is equivalent to saying that there's a principle of conservation of asymmetry. The amount of asymmetry a state has cannot be increased by processing. Bob can't suddenly gain more information about Alice's direction by processing what he's got. And now this should look a little bit familiar. It says that the measure of asymmetry of the signal that Bob receives cannot be greater than the measure of asymmetry of the source, the thing that was sent out. And that looks a lot like Curie's principle. It looks like a quantitative version of Curie's principle. And roughly speaking, what we're finding in this sort of research is that all the concepts, many of the applications of symmetry in the context of spatial configurations apply also to states of knowledge. So you can bring those concepts over and learn a lot about information processing. And I think with that, I'll stop. Thanks for your attention. So now we have lots of time to chat. And should we pass the mic around? Actually, I think passing them around would be good, yeah.
Isn't Curie's principle wrong in the case of spontaneous? Isn't Curie's principle just wrong in the case of spontaneous symmetry breaking? I mean, I can build the Leaning Tower of Pisa perfectly uniformly on soft ground, and it's going to tilt in some direction spontaneously because it's unstable.
That symmetry spontaneously. So I would say that if you're in a classical world, then I would say the prediction is that if you have something that is perfectly symmetric, a pencil standing on its point, but everything's perfectly symmetric, then the prediction is that it will not fall. It will be in an unstable equilibrium. Any perturbation to it will cause it to fall, and that perturbation will necessarily have to break the symmetry. And that perturbation, which breaks the symmetry, is the asymmetric cause of the asymmetric effect, which is that it falls in a particular direction.
That cause can be infinitesimally small.
Yes, it can. So you could say, right, that's not a challenge to Curie's principle, but maybe it's a challenge to the quantitative version of Curie's principle. Right, because that would suggest that an infinitesimally small asymmetry could somehow lead to a very big asymmetry, you know, with the pencil pointing in some direction.
Well, it does.
But I disagree. So here's the thing, that the measure of asymmetry I introduced was only for states of knowledge, not for physical configurations. And having thought this over, I don't see any reasonable way of defining a measure of asymmetry for a physical configuration. Like if I have two ellipsoidal rocks, and you know one is almost spherical, it's just a little bit ellipsoidal, And the other one is, you know, really long and narrow, very pointy. Intuitively, I might say, right, that the long, narrow one, it's much more asymmetric than this one. But is it? You know, the atom at the apex is going to pick out a direction in space just as well on the blunt rock as it does on the sharp rock. So to my mind, the only thing that it really makes sense to say has a measure of asymmetry is a probability distribution. And then, in your particular example, if I start off knowing nothing about what direction the perturbation is going to come in, so I have uniform knowledge, it's equally likely to be in any direction, then my knowledge of where it falls is also uniform. And if I start off knowing the direction which the perturbation is going to hit very precisely, then I end up knowing which way the pencil falls very precisely. The measure of asymmetry of my knowledge is preserved. There's a question over there.
Can I ask an artist's question yet?
Of course, yes.
Okay. So my question is relative to what you've said about the difference between states of reality
yes.
and states of knowledge.
Good.
And I'm wondering, well, it might not be so good. Let's see. My question is, where do those states reside? Is it purely in one being external and in the material world and one being internal in the sort of philosophical realm? And if so, how do you explain the idea of the fetish?
I'll have to come back to that last bit. Okay, let me see if I can try to explain how I view the difference between states of reality and states of knowledge. So when I specify the space of possibility for the states of reality, I see myself as specifying the ways that the world could be. So in you know, various physical theories, there's some definite claims that are made about the ways the world could be. So in Newton's theory, for example, it says, like a particle, it has a position and it has a velocity. It could be anywhere and it could have any velocity. But once you run over all the positions and all the velocities, you've specified all the ways the world could be for that particle. And so for me to tell you what its physical state is, I need to tell you exactly what its position and its velocity are. But for a state of knowledge, that is, I would say, a description of an observer's relationship to that object. So an observer might not know where it happens to be. And if we want a mathematical description of, you know, what that knowledge is, the best way to do it is to use a probability distribution. And so you can also mathematize epistemology. You can say, well, if I don't know where it is at all, then I assign a uniform probability distribution, where I'm saying that it's equally likely to be anywhere. If I have good knowledge of where I might be, then I assign a narrower distribution, and so on. So to my mind, that's a very intuitive distinction. I mean, I think we use it on a day-to-day basis. You know, we always talk about, you know, something being the case and a separate issue, whether we know it's the case or not. You know, we can really clearly separate those. I think in quantum mechanics, people have gotten deeply confused about that distinction. And there's this beautiful quote by a physicist, E.T. James, where he says that the epistemological and the ontological have gotten scrambled into an omelet by Heisenberg and Bohr that no one has yet seen how to unscramble. But that unscrambling is a prerequisite to making any further progress, because without it, we do not know what we are talking about. and I subscribe to that view. I don't know if I've answered your question.
I think it's, for me, there's some kind of realm here that I'm not honing in on it myself, whether it's the difference between possibility and probability.
Okay, so you can also try to formalize the notion of possibility, and I would say that's another good way of talking about limited knowledge. So I could, for instance, characterize my knowledge not by a probability distribution, but instead by saying, here are the positions and velocity of this particle that I deem to be possible, and here are the positions and velocities that I deem to be impossible. And that is all I know, right? So I'm not going to make a claim about which ones are more likely than which others. I'm just going to make a claim about what's possible. It's, in a sense, it's a more coarse-grained statement about what you know. But I think it's a powerful one, and it's an interesting one, and I've even speculated at times that maybe you can build up probability theory on top of a possibilistic theory. Maybe that's at root what probabilities are about.
Much of your talk was based showing a lot of patterns. Going into the information realm, it seems to be very pattern impoverished. It's just the hump. Now, I know there can be a few other kind of multiple humps and things like that, but it's nowhere nearly as complex. So is information basically pattern impoverished, or is it because we just haven't discovered the patterns in that particular world?
That's an excellent question. I haven't really thought carefully about it. Perhaps it is pattern impoverished. Last night I was thinking about a different notion of symmetry of information, which might be richer. So I talked about measures of information, and they were always defined for probability distributions. But there's another notion of information we have, which is just a property of a string, right? So if I've got some text, there's a difference between that text being just sort of random text, that text being just sort of all A's, and that text being a work of Shakespeare. We sort of feel that the one that's all A's is very simple. It's not complex at all. The one that's random is also very simple, in a sense. And the one that's Shakespeare is complex. And you can make sense of that in a precise way by saying, what's the shortest program that could generate that text? And you know, you can write a very short computer program that'll generate all A's, and you can also write a very short computer program that'll generate random letters. So they will come out as very simple, but the Shakespeare will come out as complex. So you can have a notion of information content which people call algorithmic information content, and perhaps the notion of symmetry could be applied in that case. And then I would say something. So this is very, very kind of speculative thoughts, but if you look at, you know, the pattern on a zebra, and you ask, how complex is that? You might think, oh, well, it's quite complex, because I have to specify exactly, you know, what it looks like. And you might think, well, you know, I could have written Shakespeare on the back of the zebra. You know, if the zebra had happened to, you know, been born with this particular pixels picking out Shakespeare, then it would have had Shakespeare, so it's complex. But actually, the way that the zebra pattern comes out is if there's a book by Stephen Wolfram where he talks about cellular automata. And he shows that actually you can have very simple programs that generate the sorts of patterns we see in nature, like what you'll see on a zebra or what you'll see on a shell. And so it's much more likely that the genetic code for the zebra stripes is actually a very simple code. And so what I wonder is whether there's a connection between the symmetry that exists in those forms and the algorithmic information in the sense of the code that's required to generate those forms. So as I say, I mean, that's just kind of a crazy idea, but you know, maybe there's a connection there.
So it's not a visual pattern, it's like a mathematical pattern, is what you're saying. Possibly, I guess. That's how I'm understanding it.
Well, I guess I'm sort of trying to build a bridge between the geometric patterns that we, you know, might find in the phenotype of organisms and the informational pattern that would be in their, you know, the genetic coding for those organisms. But it's not the kind of information I had here. So maybe this sort of state of information is still not pattern rich.
I have a question here. Yeah. Would you say that everything is potentially highly symmetric? I mean, maybe we just don't know about many symmetries. Maybe there's tons of symmetries we don't even realize just because we never observe them.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that is cognate with Curie's principle to some extent. So Curie would say things like, you know, you need some asymmetry to have something going on, to have a phenomena to be interested in. You need to have broken some symmetries. If everything's symmetric, it's sort of nothing interesting is happening. So I think you know, it's only when you start, you know, when you see, when symmetries become broken, that's when you see something and you start looking for the causes.
Symmetry, excuse me, is it symmetries that are broken or is it scale?
In the, do you mean like?
It may be totally symmetrical, but you're focused in too narrowly.
I see. Right. So yeah, the symmetries that you observe are definitely a function of the degree to which you've coarse grained, the scale at which you're looking at something, right? So you know, from afar, a rope will, you know, seem to have rotational symmetry and reflection symmetry, and you get closer and you say, oh no, this rope has some structure to it, and it has much less symmetry than I thought it did. Yes. So I mean, that may also be tied to a notion of symmetry of your information. So rather than saying, let's describe the symmetry of the object itself, we say, let's write down an observer's best description of that object. What do they know about that object? If they're observing it from afar, then they know less than if they're observing it from up close. And then you can ask, what's the asymmetry of their state of knowledge? And that sort of captures that notion of their uncertainty.
So one statement about this idea of you know, potential hidden symmetries is that what we call symmetric depends a lot on our perspective. And I'll give you a good example, is turbulence. Okay, so you know, you turn on the tap water and it's not, if you turn it on nice and slow, it's smooth and beautiful. You turn it on fast, you get all the bubbles in it. You go look at a stream, it's a total mess. This mess gives people like myself headaches because it's hard to describe. But and you see swirls going in every possible direction, every orientation, and you'd say, well, locally that's a highly asymmetric system. But then you notice that there's this scale invariance. Eddies on small scales are distributed in the same way as eddies on big intermediate scales and then on big scales. And that's a form of symmetry. Okay, this is a scale invariance. It's a symmetry on scales. And one of the ways that symmetry has, I think, affected the modern physical perspective is then we prioritize those properties of systems that have symmetric behavior. So I would say the individual structure of an eddy and what direction it's going on is not important. Maybe that's because I can't understand it very well. But what is important is this spectrum, this distribution of scales and relationship of things on different scales. And so there are hidden symmetries in some sense. These are symmetries that we're just, you know, waiting for us to define the relevant quantities in which they're symmetric, and then we will usually end up deciding that those are the important ones because those are the easy ones to make progress on and understand.
Yeah.
Ignored until discovered.
That reminds me of you know, the story of astronomy. If you look at the spatial configuration of the stars and, you know, you draw constellations and you try to see some pattern there, well, you don't get very far. But if instead you focus on the motions of the stars and the planets, then you start seeing some patterns. And science was born not by focusing on the spatial configuration, but by focusing on the dynamics. So it's another example of just, you know, focusing on some aspect of the phenomena because you've got a grasp on it, because you see some pattern there. I guess it goes way back to the beginning.
Yes.
Found that the example that you used of a series of the letter A as opposed to a paragraph of Shakespeare to be really interesting. And I think for me, maybe it's beginning to percolate something about the way that both scientists and artists might think similarly, which is, I think, to the average consumer of that kind of typography, that the paragraph of Shakespeare is not complex. Actually, it is self-contained, and it's understood. So it loses its complexity by being contained as that sort of unit of information. Whereas a sequence of the letter A raises, in its presumed simplicity, it doesn't rest as something simple. It becomes more complex to the questioning mind, because why are we seeing this random, specific, sequential uploading of the letter A, you know? So it sort of makes us go, well, what is that? as opposed to this paragraph of Shakespeare, which tells us what it is.
There may be something to the notion that the complexity of any object is not defined unless you specify the context. So, you know, language needs a decoder. And so it's not totally clear to me, but there might be some resonance with what you're saying. I can't quite generate an example, but it, you know, it may be that things that you would naively say, okay, the computer program that would generate this is very long, so it's complex, and this other thing, it's very short. Well, actually, you know, if you take that string together with something else, you know, some object out there in the world that's a decoder for that thing, then actually the pair of things, you know, suddenly becomes very simple rather than complex. So I think this mathematical notion of complexity may have room for the kind of context dependence that you seem to be describing. Sorry?
Of our brain.
Right.
And
what we do. I think you touched on what I was going to ask about. I'm a musician, so I'm interested in time, and you. When you just mentioned dynamic systems, I was just going to ask about symmetries that are, I mean, is it possible for symmetries to be only manifest as a, you know, through dynamics or like say through time that don't appear, you know, in terms of your, so talking about objects?
Sure,
I just wanted to hear more about time in your, I guess it's more relating to information systems.
You know, when I was talking about, say, you know, the symmetries for translations, right? You know, translations along space. You know, you could have the same pattern repeating itself, or you could have the pattern, say, repeating itself in a reflected form, or you could have the pattern repeating itself in a rotated form. You know, like all those kinds of symmetries. Well, it replaced that spatial axis with time, and say, you know, suppose I have like a melody, and then I just repeat it. Okay, well, that has a symmetry. But I could also repeat it with some transformation that's been done to it. And Giulio, who's one of our speakers today, is a pianist, and he's also an expert on symmetries. Do you want to add something to... You seem like the guy who's qualified to say something intelligent about this. Yeah.
Actually, this reminded me of a little confusion that I had when I was a teenager, indeed. While traveling, I was observing patterns from our car. And I was a musician, indeed. So I was asking myself this kind of maybe meaningless question, but what is the music, in what the music I'm doing is different from the pattern that I'm seeing? So isn't this music as well? Because I'm seeing a regularity of things, and I can imagine this as a frequency in time, even though, in fact, there are just objects sitting in space. And, well, in a sense, it was a meaningless question, but in a sense, in another sense, there is this common structure that we can observe that goes beyond the fact that we have either time or space. And so perhaps the moral of this is that we are kind of trained to decode symmetries from what we see or from what we hear, and symmetry is a signal, and this conveys a meaning. So this is something that can be realized both in the time domain with the musical composition that conveys a meaning through the symmetries or mostly perhaps the asymmetries that it has, and in the same way in a spatial arrangement of objects from which we can decode some meaning, some message that comes from the symmetries and the asymmetries of it. I don't know if this matches. Yeah. I think this matches the idea of Rob of symmetries of knowledge, that we are kind of trained by our evolution to decode patterns in what... So symmetry is a signal, in a sense, from to which we respond.
Yeah. We should wrap it up. Okay, so yeah, why don't we take a break for 5 minutes, and then we'll move to the next talk. So thanks.